Anything over 500 will go to the committee.
Yep. So please donate to STAR. She's doing a great job.
Yes.
Flying with the changes. Yeah. Give her a hand. Yeah. Thank you. All right. Thank you for serving. Okay, this is notes to the chair. All right. So welcome to the 39th Annual OK Region Convention of Narcotics Anonymous. Thank you for attending our celebration recovery in this workshop in particular. We ask that during the workshop you keep conversations to a minimum, turn cell phones off, or set to silent. The OKRCNA 39 committee also requests that all NA members attending this convention be mindful that they may be the only contact a non-addict may have with the Narcotics Anonymous Fellowship. The behavior we exhibit this weekend may long be remembered as a reflection of NA as a whole. Please remember we represent NA while attending this event. Okay, now let's open this workshop with a moment of silence and a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, the wisdom to know the difference. All right, I asked Isaiah to come up and read who is an addict. Come on, Isaiah.
I'm Isaiah, I'm an addict. Who is an addict? Most of us do not have to think twice about this question. We know our whole life and thinking was centered in drugs in one form or another, the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. We live to use and use to live. Very simply, an addict is a man or a woman whose life is controlled by drugs. We are people in the group of a continuing and progressive illness whose ends are always the same: jails, institutions, and death.
Thanks, Isaac. Oh, hey. I forgot to give you a hug. Come on up, Jay. Read the what is the NA program.
My name's Jay, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Jay.
What is the Narcotics Anonymous program? NA is a nonprofit fellowship or society of men and women for whom drugs have become a major problem. We are recovering addicts who meet regularly to help each other stay clean. This is a program of complete abstinence from all drugs. There is only one requirement for membership: the desire to stop using. We suggest that you keep an open mind and give yourself a break. Our program is a set of principles written so simply that we can follow them in our daily lives. The most important thing about them is that they work. There are no strings attached to NA. We are not affiliated with any other organizations. We have no initiation fees or dues, no pledges to sign, no promises to make to anyone. We are not connected with any political, religious, or law enforcement groups and are under no surveillance at any time that we know about. Anyone may join us regardless of age, race, sexual identity, creed, religion, or lack of religion. We are not interested in what or how much you used or who your connections were, what you have done in the past, how much or how little you have, but only in what you want to do about your problem and how we can help. The newcomer is the most important person at any meeting. The newcomer is the most important person at any meeting because we can only keep what we have by giving it away. We have learned from our group experience that those who keep coming to our meetings regularly stay clean. Thanks.
Thanks, Ted. Well, I don't think she started this. Is this on?
Hello?
I need to see. Yeah, it's on. Sorry. Blind addict. I want to make sure. It's not quite like one I got. Yeah, I see the clock ticking there. Hopefully. Okay, so this is the men's wrap, and we don't usually give introductions at the workshops, but the fact that this is my sponsor, I'm just going to give a brief one. But I've had several sponsors, you know, even this round, you know, last 16 years. And I used to not like my clean date, March 13th, 2009. The date, just for today reading, talks about that one special one. I go, well, I've had some really great sponsors, and I love and respect each one of them. A couple of them aren't with us anymore. They passed on, but a few of them are here at the convention, or two of those. And I've had sponsees that change sponsors, and I don't get all upset about that. I try to love, respect everyone, and treat everyone equally. But like I had had him a sponsor before, and I had another great sponsor. But like I was going through some stuff, and I reached, I was realizing I was closer to this guy than anybody, and he is that one special one, you know. And we both feel that. And I love and respect this man. He pours a lot into me. And all the way from Alabama, Ohio, California, Maine, Minnesota, Georgia, now Arkansas, Robert B.
Grateful for coming back. My name is Robert. I want to thank Oklahoma Regional Area Convention for inviting me. Because they invite me, I don't need to put out no disclaimers about anything I'm going to say. Anybody, a lot of people here have heard me share before, so I don't put no buffers on my sharing. I didn't put cut on my dough, so I don't do it while I'm sharing. And I like the topic of the love of the fellowship, so we could absolutely start there. I came into the room from Narcotics Anonymous. My hair was about 16 inches long, and it was matted down on my head from sleeping in the park for so long. I walked into my first meeting in a jogging suit that was three sizes too big for me. I smelt like shit, I talked like shit, and I act like shit. I stood up and I said that I was an addict, and I watched the entire room get up and hug me. The entire room said that they loved me. The entire room invited me to come back, which was absolutely amazing to me. A little background on me. I grew up in the Bronx, New York. I'm 64 years old. Pretty good looking for 64, right? Growing up in the Bronx, what you see in the Bronx is mostly pimps, dope pushers, bank robbers, gang members, you know, and that's what I inspired to be, you know, because that's all I seen. It wasn't like I was inspiring to be the president or a firefighter or a policeman, you know. I despised those people. As I begin to share, I understand that this is a men's rap. And I've been a main speaker at conventions, you know, Saturday morning, Sunday morning, but I always inspired to do the men's rap. There was something about going to the men's rap and always felt like there was something that I missed, you know. As I got more clean time, the more I felt like I had missed something, because there were so many issues that I had to deal with as growing up inside the fellowship. You know, I got clean June 5th, 1994. I put my last drug in me June 2nd, 1994. And because the lifestyle was going to kill me, I changed my date to the day I stopped living the lifestyle. You know, because if the drugs don't get you, the lifestyle will. And I understand that being in a men's rap, this is an esoteric meeting. So it's at the interest of certain people in the meeting. Some people won't understand what I talk about as a man, and some people will. But it's all the same, you know. I don't feel like there's anything that we discuss in Narcotics Anonymous that ain't good for all of us, you know. When I'm at a convention, I support every speaker. I listen to every message. And I take what's good and I use it. So for me, I talk to my I have a Saturday morning meeting with my sponsor and my grand sponsor and my great grand sponsor. And the reason why we do that every Saturday morning is that we feed each other a spiritual principle, you know. And I remember I told my grand sponsor, I said, "Hey, look, I'm sharing at the men's rap." He said, "Oh, you always wanted to do that." I said, "Yeah, I've never been nervous sharing before, but for some reason I feel a little nervous." He said, "Oh, just do like you always do." He said, "Shit, I've seen you share. You get up there and you're so freaking entertaining when you share, you know." And people who know when I share, I get adamant. I get real happy about recovery, you know. Like I said, I came to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. I had to been a seller, a plug, a user, my best customer, and just before I got to Narcotics Anonymous, I was the guy sleeping in the park, you know, hiding his dope in the light pole so he can get high in the morning because I couldn't function without my $50 worth of dope in the morning, you know. So I was grateful when I found Narcotics Anonymous. I was grateful to go to a meeting and everybody said they loved me. I was like, something is wrong with these people, you know. And then they was telling me to come back. Little did they know I was going to come back anyway. They had the free coffee, free donuts, and you could hug the finest women you ever seen. You know, and that was attractive to me. So coming into the fellowship, I realized a lot of love. And then I got a sponsor. So my sponsor has 3 years more clean than me. And when I first got clean, what it was that we only had the basic text. And we would get together after the meeting and we would go to each other's house in the basement, living room, wherever. We call it in the basement. And we would sit down and we would dissect that book, and because it said so many amazing things about our lifestyle, you know. So we became literature thumpers, NA police, you know. Don't come to the meeting and share something that's not really in the book. In other words, don't do that. And after I had like 8 months clean, I was like, "Hey, dude, you know, why don't you sponsor me?" He said, "Sure, I will sponsor you." He said, "But first thing you got to do is you got to change your attitude, you know." And at by 8 months clean, there were some people in the rooms who had cleaned me up. I had a female with 8 years wash my knees. My knees was black, you know, black rings on my knees, and she scrubbed my knees for me. And I thought it was going to be sexual, but you know, it didn't happen. And she said, "You need to clean yourself up." And I had other people take me to the barbershop and cut my hair. You know, I couldn't comb my shit; it was just matted. You know, cut my hair off, and gave me some clothes. You know, like, "Hey, wear some clothes that fit you." You know, regardless of the fact that I was about 135 pounds, you know, and I'm still trying to get back there. I don't know why. But it was those things that made me feel good about myself. And as I began to work the steps, I began to realize that there was things about me that I didn't understand why I behaved that way or why I thought that way, you know? And a lot of times we get in here, we blame every fucking thing on the disease, you know? And yes, we had certain mannerisms and certain behaviors that the disease had created for us. But there's a lot that was going on inside of me. My past traumas, my past behaviors, my past things that had worked their way into my disease. So, sharing with my sponsor, and I told him, I said, "Hey, look, you know, the literature tells us that we must surrender, you know, abstinence and then surrender. But how do we get there? How do we get to the surrender, you know? And how do we get to the surrender? We must be defeated. We must actually put up the white flag and say, 'Hey, I cannot fight no more.'" Our literature says that when the means and the things that we was using didn't work anymore, we did surrender. You know, and I come to find out with my years clean that there's so many areas inside my life that I need to surrender to. And I can't surrender to them until I find out where they came from. You know? I come from a large family. I have 10 brothers and sisters. Never had an affectionate mother. In other words, there was no hugging and kissing and come here, baby, or laying in her lap, none of that shit. And it always bothered me. You know, I had to get clean to realize that it's kind of hard to love on 11 kids. You know, that takes up too much of your time with cooking and cleaning and, you know, putting up with my dad, who was a straight asshole. You know, he never whooped me. He just punched me. You know, I never got a whooping from my dad. He would punch the shit out of me in public, no matter where it was, like, bam, right in the chest. And I grew up feeling indifferent. And I felt indifferent because I was a mixed breed. My father was Jewish, my mother was Afro-Latino, and everybody around me seemed to pick that apart. So I went through my childhood trying to fit in somewhere, you know? I was small at stature, and I'm short, you know? I felt a complex with that, you know? I've always seeked out love in places that I never was able to get it, you know, was never able to get it. And the more I did that, the more problems I created for myself, you know. I was looking back this morning with the meditation with my sponsor and grand sponsor, and I was talking about being in Webster Park. So if you know anything about New York, Webster Park is a big park. And it has like rows and rows of handball walls where you go play handball. And I remember getting into a fight with a guy, and he was a Black Spade. It's a gang that was in the area when I was growing up. And they whooped the shit out of me. Like two or three of them beat the shit out of me. And I remember going home all bloody and shit and beat up. And my dad met me at the door. He's like, yeah, I heard. So somebody had already told my dad I got my ass kicked at the park. He met me at the door with a baseball bat. He said, don't come home till there's blood on the bat. And then I learned a lesson there that I actually had to defend myself. And I went through life like that. Anybody that was bigger than me had to look out for me because I didn't have a conversation. I would hurt you, you know. And that crossed over after my addiction to the point where my abuse was so much that I abused my first wife so bad that I would hold her down and choke her until she submitted to me, you know. And I remember the judge telling me, if you ever put hands on her again, I'm going to lock you up for life, you know. And that scared me, and I haven't hit a woman since that time, you know. But outside of the judge, my first wife woke me up with a knife. And she's like, if you ever do it again, I'll kill you. And I felt vulnerable. Was married 3 times in recovery. My first wife was with me in high school. I met her in high school, and I would buy her things to go, because she was in higher grade than me, and I would buy her things to go to the high school with her and show all the older boys, I got one of y'all women, you know. We had a child. She was 17 and I was 15. And when I turned 16, I got kicked out of the house. My father put me, her, and my 3-month-old baby out of the house. And we had to fend for ourselves. So I started selling heroin. And I had to sell the heroin because I was living with my uncle who had came back from Vietnam, who had a heroin habit. And he had a certain amount he had to have every day, you know. And so I was like, it's easier just to sell the heroin and give him what he needed so he don't be sick. Because I was more concerned about him being sick. But he had certain mannerisms and certain things that he did. So I went to school. I worked at the paint factory. Putting the lids on the cans at night, and I sold heroin part-time. And those things kind of laid inside my spirit, you know. When I was 22 years old, I lost a two-year-old child. And when I lost that two-year-old child, I lost that wife. In other words, we couldn't put it back together. It was just done. And I remember I was going to jail for attempted murder, and she came to the jailhouse. She said, "I filed for divorce." You know, she said, "I filed for divorce." I said, "Well, great. You know, live a happy life. You know, being the hard ass that I thought I was." And not quite yet getting over the loss of the child, you know. So it was 16 months later, and I got my case reduced to assault with a deadly weapon because I shot a guy that had busted out the windows on my house and was banging on my door, and he backed out to the mailbox, which in Mississippi, you got a certain distance from your house, you could shoot somebody, you know. And I shot him after he got that distance away from the house. And I didn't shoot him one time. I shot him seven times with a 15-shot clip of a 9mm. Blew all his intestines out and put him in a wheelchair. And by the grace of God, I got out of that. My second wife, me and her got high. We was getting high together. She was more of a drinker and a weed smoker, and I was just like whatever was on the table, you know, because I was trying to sell whatever was on the table. And I lost my third child in that marriage, a baby girl. And at that point, I was going to the park, parking in the park, and actually shooting up my own product in my arm. Doing it privately, didn't want nobody to know. And at that time, not knowing anything about the disease of addiction, it escalated into where I didn't care who knew. It escalated into I didn't want to sell no more. I just wanted to get high, you know. And I got busted a couple of times, and I went to prison. So that's the backstory, you know. That's the backstory. I went to prison. I did some time in prison, and in '92 I got out of prison. And when I got out of prison, I was still suffering from the loss of those children. In other words, I hadn't dealt with the grief of the loss of the children, and getting high seemed like it eased it, you know? So when I came to the Rooms Narcotics Anonymous and I got this sponsor, and he said some simple shit to me. He said, "Hey, look, man, if you don't pick up, you can't use, you know? If your most comfortable place is in a meeting, then have your ass in a meeting." So I was at a meeting like all the fucking time. Like, I didn't have no job. I didn't have nothing to do but go to meetings. I go to the morning meeting. I go to the noon meeting. I go to two or three evening meetings, you know. And I had all the crazy thoughts that we have, you know. There was guys in there that had gold on and wads of money and fine-ass girls and driving a nice car. And I'm like, these motherfuckers are selling dope, you know. But I only had a 10-speed, but I would follow that motherfucker around. I follow him across town to the next meeting, you know what I'm saying? Because in my beginnings, I thought, because women come into the rooms and they put a little weight on. They start looking a little decent, you know? And their wives and girlfriends was hugging me. I was like, they want me, you know? But that's to say that those are the things that keep us coming back. You know, and this is the front end of the story, that all those issues that I talked about in the backstory was coming up inside my regular life now. So I got 18 months clean. I got clean in 94. In 97, I married another female. Now, the process to getting to marrying another female was that I went through 6 months of my sponsor putting condoms on my front porch every day, every week. Well, every week he would drop off a bag of condoms on the porch. You know, because when I got clean, I had already witnessed girls that was tricking for me dying from the virus. So I came into the Rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, and the first time that I shared that, they was like, "Come on, you're gonna go get tested." And back then you had to wait a couple of weeks to get your results. So I was, when I went to get tested, I died before I got my results back. In other words, I killed myself. You know, I went home and gave away my TV and all my clothes and my sneakers. I'm like, okay, I'm going to die. I got the virus, you know. And that comes from misinformed information from misinformed people, because I knew nothing about the virus other than that I had watched people die from it. Turns out I didn't have the virus, and my sponsor was like, okay, you can't keep your dick in your pants, so let's put something on your dick, you know. Let's put a raincoat on it. And then that way, until you learn how to keep your dick in your pants, you'll be protecting yourself. And I had like a year clean. I told him, I said I want to experience a relationship. I want a girlfriend, you know. And I remember telling him that. He's like, a girlfriend? So all you know about is being a hoe, you know. And I was like, no, I was a pimp. He's like, yeah. Yeah, you know, and he tells me today, he says, you know, a fantasy, your feet never hit the ground. He says, so you've been living a fantasy, so your feet never hit the ground, so you never really did any goddamn thing, you know. So I told him that, and he actually told me, he said, well, you got to know what a female wants, because obviously you've been married 2 times. He said, did you get married because of, I said, I got married the first time because of children. I got married the second time because I had a get high partner. You know what I'm saying? So I didn't know anything about love. And he's like, well, you know, love takes some time, and you need to get your definition for love, and you need to go to the women's meeting and sit in the back of the room. And I did. I went in the women's meeting, I sat in the back of the room. And I heard some shit that I didn't know. You know? I had been married to the first wife for almost 10 years, the second wife for 5 years. But I know a lot of things about women, you know. I didn't know they bitches when they get the administration. I mean, it was like oblivious to me, you know. I mean, and when you stay high and drunk all the time, you don't really hear shit, you know. I didn't know that, you know, they have certain ways of showing their affection. You know, she might not never give me a fucking kiss, but she'll always have my lunch ready and my breakfast ready and my dinner ready. And my clothes would always be cleaned and ironed. You know? And sitting back there, I heard that, like, oh, that's love? That's showing love? You know? And it was years later when I heard this shit on fucking Oprah, and I'm like, there's a language of love. I'm like, oh, fuck. What's my language, you know? So I sat back there, and I got a girlfriend from out of that meeting, you know, and she became my wife, you know, and she was working the program and doing everything, and my insecurities kept the marriage from escalating into something beautiful. Now I don't talk about whatever she did. She did do some shit that, you know, that was probably unacceptable to most men. But we're gonna talk about me. I had a lot of insecurities. I had the small man factor, you know. I had the factor that, you know, okay, you talk all that shit about me, but you always come every time we lay down, so you bullshit, you know. And she said some shit that hurt my feelings. I know how to fake. Like, you're faking, okay. So she had 2 children. She had a girl and a boy. The boy and the girl was 3 years apart. And then she got pregnant with the third child. And she told me she didn't want the third child because I forced myself on her. I said, I didn't force myself on you. She said, yeah, I told you to get up before you ejaculate, and you decided to stay. And I said, well, you know, what you want me to do? I mean, we're doing this for a reason, you know, for everybody to reach a climax. Well, she was pregnant, she left. She started back gambling. She's pregnant with my youngest son now. I had a son in between that. And she stayed going 8 months. And during those 8 months, she fucked up $15,000. She left a brand new car on the side of the road. She come home once a week, And when it was time to have the baby, she came home and she gave me the baby at 2 weeks old and she left again. And I divorced her. I was like, I ain't putting up with this bullshit. You know, all my sponsees and all my recovery people was like, you ain't got to put up with that, just divorce her. You know, it's a good time to divorce her. You won't have to give her nothing, you know, just divorce her. And it was at that time that I realized that I actually loved somebody. In other words, I had experienced love for my first time, you know. And I remember my sponsor telling me, said, well, you know, don't get to acting out. So the thing about the disease of addiction is that I need to be aware. We came in here, we was aware that there was a drug problem. But check it out. Are you aware that you have a money spending problem? Are you aware that you have being led around by the little head problem? Are you aware that you don't, you're in love with the thought of being in love, you don't really love no fucking body. In other words, it looks good to be in love, it looks good to have a wife, it looks good to take care of your children, you know? Are you aware of those things? Are you aware that you suffer from a thing where your image have to stand out all the time, you know? Because I remember being clean in the beginning and shit, I had a fucking diamond ring on every finger. I wanted to show you what recovery was doing. You know, I had a fucking gold chain. I had 2 new cars in the yard, you know? And my disease, I started off with a one-bedroom house, a wife and a daughter. And what I did was I took the program of Narcotics Anonymous to a new level, because I was so happy and addicted to the program, and folks was asking me to share here and share there, you know what I'm saying? Till in 1 year I lost that house because I had went to 19 conventions. You know, without spending more money on plane tickets, how I look, hotel rooms, you know? And if we don't get the awareness, we don't have the opportunity to fix it. And back then, my sponsor told me, said, there's 5 A's to the first step. And if you ain't doing these 5 A's to the first step, guess what? You're fucking stuck. You know what I'm saying? You need to be aware of what's going on. I don't want to misquote my sponsor. Hell no. You need to be aware of what's going on. So I used to carry this stuff around in the beginning of my recovery. They was like, you know, in the beginning we didn't have all these fucking cell phones and shit. They was like, keep 50 cents in your damn pocket and a phone list. You know? And that was the beginning of my gratitude list. You know, 2 fucking quarters and a phone list. You know, because anything happens, I'm calling your ass. He said, after you get the awareness of what's going on, accept it. Because if you don't accept it, you don't have the opportunity to fix it. Our literature tells us and this is out of It Works Out Why, we have found that we cannot recover without the ability to be honest. So if we're not honest about what's going on, we're stuck in the fucking problem. You know? I was sharing with somebody earlier. If your problem is giving head, then guess what? If you don't do something about giving head, you will always give fucking head. You know? And I've been places where I hear them share like that, like I don't dream about dope no more. I dream about turning tricks. You know? And we don't realize that's the problem. So we create an act. If one of our character defects show up, it's not showing up by its damn self. It's bringing all its friends with it. You know what I'm saying? It takes a lot to lie. A whole lot, because you got to tell a lie to cover up a lie. Then you gotta manipulate the people that you're telling the fucking lie to. Then you gotta put on an illusion that the lie is true. You know? And all these other character defects just show the fuck up. It's like being in a basketball game and you're the only person on your team. So I got a sponsor who made me go back and look at things, you know? And it started out after I divorced my wife. I was in Louisiana working, and she came down to Louisiana, and we had a terrific weekend. And my sponsor called my sponsor, said, "Oh, she's here, we're having a great weekend." And he says, "When somebody tells you who they are, believe them." He says, "She already told you who she was." I said, "No, she's changed. Before I left Louisiana, I remarried her. 4 years later, I divorced her again." You know? And I spent the next 15 years paying for the home, paying for the car, paying all the bills, while she gambled every dime she made at the casino. And my sponsor took me all the way back. He took me back to my beginnings, to my first wife, you know, buying the soda pop and the bag of potato chips, you know, getting her a new outfit. He said, you said you was a pimp. You might have had some hoish behaviors, but you've been a trick your entire fucking life. So when you realize you're a trick, what do? So I backed out, and I tried to gravitate to people who have some substance. But being a human being and my dis-ease is that I want to be loved. I want to be loved by somebody. That's a dis-ease. My dis-ease in life from my mother all the way to the dis-ease of the disease has reflected itself in all of my relations. And I've actually loved somebody after that hurt me. And when you love somebody that actually hurts you, but say that they love you, it's hard for you to believe. Especially when you've already been in that situation before. You know? And the funny thing about this aspect of the disease is that when you're acting out in these funny areas like tricking, it affects you the same fucking way. You can't pay your bills. You don't have gas money. You're buying somebody else something before you buy yourself something. I love you. I love you. I love you, you know. And I seem to not think about me until the moment of surrender. That means I actually have to give up. I can say I surrender a million fucking times, but if I don't give up, I'm still stuck in the same damn place. Surrender is effective with, like the other A in the first step, action. And action requires abstinence. So I could be aware, I could admit, but if I don't take action and I don't create abstinence, then anything in my fucking life that is controlling me, because most of the time it's something outside of me that controls me. But guess what? I'm the creator of all my fucking problems. Nobody tied me up to do shit. It's me with my sick thinking. It's me with my sick behavior. You know? It's me doing shit that doesn't equal up to recovery. You know? Our literature says that we seek what God's will is for us. And if we don't know what that is, we just keep coming to the meeting, and some way or another, it happens. It happens for us. God's will starts to show up inside our life. The more we work the steps, the more it shows up. You know, I can't allow something greater than myself to help me if I don't first have the abstinence in any area of my life. You know, we come in here and we get stuck on the drugs, I have blamed so much shit on the disease, you know. The disease did not go out and spend $40,000 on diamond rings. I did. The disease didn't sit him on the dresser for his wife to take him and go hock him. I did. You know? So I, you know, and I tell my sponsor, I said, she took my shit. She took. He said, shit. You knew who she was. Why you put him on the fucking dresser? You know she was looking for money to use. And she didn't, and it was hard for me to comprehend because she wasn't using drugs. She was using the casino. You know, and somewhere in my sick mind, she was gonna be okay. She wasn't okay, you know. So I had reservations of her getting better when I remarried her, you know. And reservations, they say, is an opening for you to relapse, you know. And I was in such pain, I let the little head lead me to the first pair of legs that slung open, and I ended up with another child. Which leads me to the second thing I want to talk about in the men's rep. It's our children. It's our children, our relationships with our children. So even in acts of addiction, I would pay child support. Yeah, I could say because I love my children, yeah. But I didn't want to go to jail. They would, you know, they'd take your fucking license. They'd lock your ass up. They'll fine you no matter where you're at. Especially if you're using Social Security number, you know. So my rationalization and justification seemed to be a benefit for me taking care of my children. So I had these two sons that was living from the first marriage, and I had to think about the damage that I did to them. So I was selling dope when they was growing up, and I would tell them, you know, they was like, Dad, I want these shoes and I want these clothes. And I'm like, fucking here. Get on that corner, I'll keep an eye on you. Sell some shit and get you some shit, you know? So when it got in high school and they were selling shit and I was clean, it was like, holy fucking shit. I taught these boys this bullshit, you know? And so I was living in Ohio and I brought them up there, and my son was like, look at all these people who love you and hug you. And I'm like, yeah, son, I was looking for love in all the wrong places because I wanted to be my dad. You know, that back trauma, that back pain that we never talk about, I wanted to be my dad. People in the neighborhood respected my dad. He was a Jewish man, and most Jews in New York City want to be fucking Italian gangsters. Just the truth. So he had a lucrative drug business, and folks in the neighborhood borrowed money from him. And when they seen my dad, they treated him with real respect. And when they see me, like, oh, you bring son. Oh, come here, baby. Here's this. I wanted people to treat me that way. And I thought I was going to get it by selling drugs. But see, my father wasn't an addict. He wasn't an addict like me. Matter of fact, he told me, he's like, shit, never use that. And he had a bag of white powder. He was talking about cocaine. Never use that. So he knew, you know, never put a needle in your arm. You know, but I was looking for that kind of respect, and I had found it in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. I found people who loved me and respect me for exactly who I was. I hadn't had to put no additives to it. You know, the gold and the diamonds and the cars and the good-looking women that I dated was all for me. They didn't give a fuck what I was doing, as long as I stayed clean. You know what I'm saying? And then I had to deal with the fact that there were so many quiet insecurities going on. Remember I talked about being short and having to hit somebody with a bat? Those little quiet insecurities was ruling my life, you know? So I gave up looking for love in all the wrong places. I found somebody to love. I had a pretty decent relationship. It ended not in the way I wanted it to end. But what it did was it taught me a lesson that, you know, I can't control anyone. I have to accept somebody for exactly who they are and let them be who they are. And if it's not part of my program, walk away from it. Let it go. Do whatever I got to do not to hurt someone. Because guess what? I've been hurt enough. I don't want to hurt people like they hurt me, you know. And I'm pretty good at hurting people. I'm pretty good at tearing up shit in my life. You know what I'm saying? So I had a 12-year-old son die, and the circumstances of his death, fucking amazing to me. I hit 25 years clean. He was living with my ex-wife, his stepmother, and his other three brothers and sisters. And she dropped them off at a birthday party. And I try to share this without, you know. She dropped them off at a birthday party on Friday. It's an overnight birthday party. And I get a call Monday on the job. I'm working in Amarillo, Texas, at the Hertford plant, building that. I'm superintendent, a project superintendent. I actually had a girlfriend on site. And I'm like, just devastated. I didn't know what to do, you know. I go home, he's got tubes in his mouth, he's laying in the bed, and you know, we're thinking because he was throwing up and shit, we're thinking, okay. They was like, he put a bunch of gum in his mouth and he choked on it, and I'm like, he did? You know, and that shocked me because my two-year-old son that died in my first marriage choked on a piece of Halloween candy. So I'm feeling this euphoria, like, what the fuck, am I cursed? What's going on? You know? So he had passed, and they was like, okay, we got a certain amount of time. Do y'all want to, you know, donate the organs, you know, to get some other people, keep some other people alive? And his mom, his actual birth mother showed up because she had been in prison for abuse. He was 3 years old before I know I had the child. They called me and said, hey, we got your son down here. We need you to come in and do a DNA test to prove that he's your son, and then you can take him home. And she had left him inside the projects where she lived at, and he was running around butt naked, going to people's houses and climbing up on shelves and eating their food, and you know, and she was out getting high. She had relapsed. And I remember going down to Children's Services with my ex-wife at the time, and she's like, well, what are you gonna do? I'm like, I don't know. I'm gonna go down here and take a DNA. And I'm like, I'm bringing you because guess what? I'm traveling, working, and if he's my child, I want him to grow up with his brothers and sisters. You know, I'm paying for this house, I'm paying all the bills. You're driving a car I'm paying for. You know, there's no excuse why you can't let him stay with his brothers and sisters. And she said, okay, yeah, I can do that. And I love her for that. I appreciate her for that. And we walked in there and we sat down, and this is little damn boy, he just ran. We looked at him like, she's like, we don't even need a DNA test. We know that one's yours. He looked like all the other ones, and he acted like all the other ones did when they was little. So I took the DNA test and they let me take him home. I was pissed because they was I make good money, so they was making me pay $1,900 a month for somebody who's in jail for abuse of the child. And he's living in my home. I'm like, is y'all motherfucking crazy? What kind of shit is that? You know? But when he passed, so I'm there for a couple of days. I stay 2 weeks, do the funeral, give him a nice burial, donate his organs to other people who, you know, a lot of those people wrote letters, and, you know, there was three other people who stayed alive after he died. Let's just put it that way. And I get back to Texas, and I'm telling my current girlfriend, I'm like, they said he died from ethanol. She said, what? I mean fentanyl. He died from fentanyl. I said, well, how the fuck did he die from fentanyl? So the owners of the house, the female poster had 9 years, she had relapsed, she had fentanyl on the table with a dollar bill on it in a plate, and he grabbed the dollar bill, sniffed the line of the shit, and it killed him. At this point, it's all I can do not to kill the individual whose house he was at. But then I'm thinking, he went to a Friday night birthday party, and my ex-wife didn't pick him up till Monday. He died on a Monday. She didn't even come to pick him up. He ended up in the hospital dead on a Monday. her addiction of gambling left him there for that long, enough for him to die. So I'm trying to get by with the emotions of all that. Because, you know, we always say that the old us shows up and shit happens, you know. The killer in me was going to show up. And the police were saying they couldn't find the person house he was at. She was hiding. They couldn't find her. And I told my girlfriend, I said, I'm going to Ohio. I went to Ohio for 3 days. I found her ass because they don't know where the dope houses is. I do, you know. Found her ass. She went to court, got locked up. And I couldn't get over this thing inside of me for hating my ex-wife. You know, it was just icking inside my stomach. And my sponsor told me, said, there's a funny thing that God does. He allows us to love somebody in order to forgive them. And he reminded me that she raised that boy from 3 years old to 12 years old. And I need to love the fact that she did that. I don't need to hate her. I need to remember that she's an addict like me, and her disease took her somewhere that she probably didn't want to go. And that allowed me to forgive her. Not that I forget, I forgave her. And I got fucked up with taxes. Tax man came after me, and it wasn't his first time, it was like his third time. He fucked with me back when I was selling drugs. You know, where they come in and they just come in like, oh, you gotta take care of this, and they put a tape all the way around your fucking house and shit. And like, my car's in there. No, you can't have your car either. You can't even go in the fucking house, you know. And I was telling Dwight, I had a life insurance policy on myself that I had been paying for 35 years. You know, I started paying it before I got clean, and I continued to pay it. And I told them guys when they arrested me, I said, I ain't got no money. They said, well, we're going to lock you up. You know, then they came to me, he's like, you can cash in your life insurance policy. I'm like, well, you lock me up for fucking 5.5 months, then you tell me I can cash in my life insurance policy. You know, but their motto is that you pay us no matter what. A pint of blood, 10 years of your life, or cash money. You know? And my ex-wife took me to court because she wanted to have the house. So she put that in process while I was locked up. That the house needs to be in her name. She needs to have the house. And my ex-girlfriend had all but turned herself in. She had clean time, and she was like, I don't got to go do this time. And she had a little girl, which we love, and I started off taking care of her, and then I had to go home and take care of that. And one thing led to another, you know. And I'm at home, and I'm trying to figure out, man, how did I get here? Listen, I love you. How did I get here? I want to blame the ex-wife. I want to blame the federal government, you know. I want to blame everybody, but nobody created the situation but me. I created the situation. When I divorced her, I should have never let her stay in the fucking house. Should have been like, get the fuck out. I should have took responsibility for my kids. I should have been responsible enough to pay my taxes when they sent me the first letter, not 5 years later get locked up. You see, it's my inability to assess personal responsibility. Because guess what? A guy making $170,000 a year should not be fucking not paying his taxes. And this comes straight from my sponsor. He's like, you created all that shit. You wasn't responsible. And you had the ability to be responsible. So when you're aware of something, you need to admit it, be honest about it, take some action, and become abstinent from it. So, which I only got a few minutes left. Five. So I got me a little apartment. I left my job. I took the supposedly little girl that we loved. I gave it to her grandmother. I went and got me a little one-bedroom apartment, and I was suffering, man. Just so happens, you know, the girl who had turned herself in and got locked up for a little while was getting out, and, you know, she would send me groceries, and I wouldn't answer the phone. I wouldn't go to the door. I was so fucking depressed, man. I'm like, what the fuck have I done to my life 25 years clean? What have I done? I didn't want to answer the door. I didn't want to see anybody. Like, fuck that. You know? And I'm trying to get money out of my 401k. I got a lot of money in 401k. I'm trying to get it. You know, again, you know. Nobody has close, you know, at that time I had close to $1 million in 401k. I'm like, y'all, give me my money. They're like, no, you took money out last year. You know? We can't give you no more loans. You're not paying this loan back. And I'm like, oh, fuck, what am I going to do? And the folks at the apartment gave me, what was it, like 2 weeks to get out? 1 week? And it was just before our family retreat. So the love of the fellowship I face, we're like a sponsee family that meets in Florida at a park with anywhere from 200 to 500 men take over the entire park. And I called my sponsor, I can't come. He's like, yeah, hell you can. I said, I'm getting evicted. He said, I don't give a shit if you're getting evicted. You're going to come here. And with $50 in hand, I drove down to Florida. At the same time, I wasn't working. I had just quit a job at a treatment center. Because I went to a treatment center. I'm like, okay, I can work, you know. McDonald's, Walmart, I can get a fucking job, you know. But because of my depression, I quit the job at the treatment center and was getting evicted. And I drove down to Florida with $50. And I got to the retreat, and everybody, you know, I have a lot of sponsee brothers, and they was hugging me and sticking money in my pocket. I'm talking about love and fellowship. I'm talking about they was just like sticking money in my pocket. So I'm not going to count it. I'm not going to count it. I'm not even going to look at it till I get ready to go home. And I had an amazing weekend at sponsee family retreat. And everybody loved me, and everybody cared about me, and everybody, you know, was like, hey, take responsibility for your actions. We love you, and we're gonna help you get past this. I did a job interview on Facebook. I did a Zoom job interview, and we was at the gun range, so folks are shooting guns. I got a torch in my hand, flamethrower. And the guy's like, what the fuck are you doing? We're at the gun range and we're just trying our guns. I went, did the interview. I told him, okay, tomorrow. And I didn't tell the guy I was homeless, because I was homeless. I didn't tell the guy I didn't have any money. He said, man, your resume is amazing, because I had spent 20, the fellowship had gave me enough that I spent 21 years with the same company, went from a welder, iron worker to a superintendent. So I had a hell of a good resume. In other words, I built projects from anywhere from $70 million to $410 million. You know, and he's like, oh yeah, we want you to, we'll send you a plane ticket, whatever, we don't want you to come up to Pittsburgh. I was like, oh, I got a car. He said, oh, just drive on up here, we'll handle all expenses, we got a room waiting on you. And that's how God works. That's how God works. I didn't lose faith. I didn't give up. I didn't stop. You know what I'm saying? And I stopped at the gas station when I was leaving there, and I had $760 in my pocket from my sponsee brothers. You know? So for real, the program with Narcotics Anonymous will love on you, but you have to do some work. You have to be aware of these things that are creeping into this new way of life and taking over this new way of life. And it's easy to get there because you're like, I'm not using, I ain't hurting nobody but me. Shit. If you hurt enough, you better fix it. Look, I don't know if anybody heard anything. I just shared, you know, my experience, strength, and hope. And there was a lot of other stuff I wanted to say about, you know, all the way wet, all the way left, but God has his way of doing what he do, you know. Yeah. I want to talk about, you know, stupid shit, you know, like all the places my dick led me, you know. which is very entertaining. I'm sure everybody got an entertaining message for that, you know. But when we stop looking for love in all the wrong places, so I've spent the past couple of years alone, you know. But when I came out of my depression, I tore that page out of my book of life. I'm like, I don't have to live like this anymore. You know, I don't have to worry about nothing. My kids are grown. All of them are grown. All of them I put through college. I got two granddaughters I'm putting through college right now. That's because I can. You know, I just bought a building in Thailand because that's where I'm going to retire to. Open up a restaurant, got some people running it, and it's being prosperous, you know. But I just made up my mind, I want to just retire and live my life joyfully and peacefully, you know, without hurting myself, you know. We can look at all the people we hurt because we hurt a lot of people, but shit, stop hurting yourself. And guess what? Like the character defects, if you ain't hurting yourself, guess what? You ain't hurting no damn body else. I'm Grateful Recovering Addict. Thank you for letting me share.